So as I said in my email today, I was rather shocked and disturbed to learn that Steve Bannon is a big fan of the Bhagavad Gita. Gets one thinking about how important it is to probe deep into the mystery of any text, especially something as complex and multi-layered as Bhagavad Gita. How easy it is for an ego to twist the most sublime philosophical articulation of truth into a rationale for doing pretty adharmic things. It's such an oxymoron. Here's this text that's all about dharma, and here's someone using it to basically justify white supremacy. Pretty amazing. And war, I think for someone like that, you can just sort of get caught up in chapter one, never go beyond chapter one, and just be all caught up in the notion of a so-called righteous war, and then one is off and running. And that's so not what this text is about. It's just a metaphor. It's just a metaphor that sets up a very extreme situation to try to make a point about action, about right action.
Is that what people do with the Bible?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I'm sure all the sacred texts, they all get twisted up. I've been reflecting in the last couple of days on all these pivot points in my life where my deep intuitive voice was saying clearly the action I should take, and I was either too wounded, too scared, too indifferent, too obstinate, too rebellious, etc., to listen, and I went the other way instead, and created all kinds of difficulties for myself in this life. And I think really, in essence, that's what this text is trying to suggest to us. Like this whole notion of the self, kind of wrestling with how to articulate my understanding. I'm not quite there yet. I think the simplest way to say it is like, our intuition is a voice, it's a portal of that deep self. And like the self, it's really subtle. And it gets easily covered over with all the stuff of mind that we've been talking about, and looking at Patanjali probably says the most coherent analysis of that we come across in the yogic system. All that stuff that clogs up our ability to be aligned with what this text is talking about in terms of right action. And we end up not going there. You know, we end up being, again, pulled by the so-called play of opposites. I did a session with somebody last week. Something about certainty. And I think this person was experiencing a lot of uncertainty and wanting to have certainty. But I was thinking as I was listening, well, no. Certainty and uncertainty, they're just opposite poles. You know, what we want is clarity. Certainty can be a very hard, rigid, it can be quite stuck, you know. Uncertainty kind of waffles around, driving everyone around it slightly crazy. And certainty can be quite destructive. I suppose clarity is a kind of certainty that's held in compassion, perhaps, but not even. It's just clarity, it's just clarity. So let me read you a little bit, and then I'm going to read you some Mary Oliver, who, as usual, I think says it better and more simply in one poem instead of all these chapters. And then I'll read you a little Kabir that just kind of cracked me up. So this is chapter 2. So we've established last week there's a battle between the so-called good guys and the so-called bad guys. Arjuna has had his nervous breakdown on the battlefield. Krishna's come and is giving him the teachings of yoga. Chapter 2 begins. And again, I read some of this last week. Although you mean well, Arjuna, your sorrow is sheer delusion. Wise men do not grieve for the dead or for the living. He's going to get a little bit caught up now in sort of Hindu concepts of reincarnation and eternal blah 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 blah. But I'm going to read it anyway and see if you can, don't take it literally. Really let the metaphors be more expansive inside of your mind. I think there's a deeper message here about what we're afraid to kill inside of ourselves and what will never die inside of ourselves. Never was there a time when I did not exist or you. And again, the thing about Krishna that's so interesting in this text, Krishna is really the voice of the self, Om Namah Shivaya. It's the voice of that deep, luminous presence inside of us that's been personified as God or divine, whatever we want to call it. But it's just like, that's the voice, again, from the yogic perspective of what we truly are. That's who's talking here. Never was there a time when I did not exist, or you, or these kings, nor will there come a time when we cease to be. Just as in this body the self passes through childhood, youth and old age, so after death it passes into another body. And again, we need not get caught up in reincarnation. It's enough to just think about that aspect of ourself that has been with us for as long as we remember. And the body is always changing. And the body will ultimately fall away. No one really knows for sure if that presence keeps going, but it seems like it does. And I know we've talked about this so many times over the years. I remember like yesterday when I was 4 years old. And in many ways, I don't feel all that different. I have a lot more wisdom. But that essence that I recognize as myself, it's the very same me-ness that I felt 60-odd years ago. And I'm sure this is true for everyone in this room. And that essence, that's the doorway into this experience that the yoga system names the self. Physical sensations, cold and heat, pleasure and pain, there's the play of opposites, are transient. They come and go. So bear them patiently, Arjuna. Only the man or woman who is unmoved by any sensations, the wise man, indifferent to pleasure, to pain, is fit for becoming deathless. But by deathless, he really means not caught in that play of opposites. Right? That's what deathless is really referring to. Non-being can never be. Being can never not be. It's a bit of a Zen koan. Both these statements are obvious to those who have seen the truth. Of course, to the rest of us, they're not obvious at all. Non-being can never be. Being can never not be. The presence that pervades the universe is imperishable. And that's that same presence that's inside of us, unchanging, beyond both is and is not. How could it ever vanish? These bodies come to an end, but that vast embodied self is ageless, fathomless, eternal. And then, you know, it's so interesting, therefore you must fight, Arjuna. It's so interesting to use this teaching in this particular context to justify, so go kill your relatives. If you think that this self can kill, or think that it can be killed, you do not well understand reality's subtle ways. It never was born. Coming to be, it never will not be. Birthless, primordial, it does not die when the body dies. The sharpest sword will not pierce it. The hottest flame will not singe it. Water will not make it moist. Wind will not cause it to wither. It cannot be pierced or singed, moistened or withered. It is vast, perfect, and all-pervading, calm, immovable, timeless. It is called the inconceivable, the unmanifest, the unchanging. If you understand it in this way, you have no reason for your sorrow. Once we get that that same essence that is inconceivable, unmanifest, unchanging, is the same in all of us, that's when we really begin to get this notion of the utter and absolute interconnectedness of all life. The self who dwells in the body is inviolable forever. Forever, inviolable forever. Therefore, you have no cause to grieve for any being, Arjuna. Know what your duty is and do it without hesitation. Remember, these early chapters are the yoga of action. For a warrior, there is nothing better than a battle that duty enjoins. And again, by duty, he's talking about dharma. The self who dwells in the body is inviolable forever. Therefore, you have no cause to grieve for any being, Arjuna. And we could say, and we have no cause to grieve for the so-called wrong decision. Because there's always another chance. Know what your duty is and do it without hesitation. For a warrior, there is nothing better than a battle that duty enjoys. For a human being, there's nothing better than being absolutely engaged in our life with every ounce of our presence. That's what this text is about. Blessed are warriors who are given the chance of a battle like this. Blessed are those of us who are given a life that we can dive into head first and really embrace with every fiber of our being, which calls them to do what is right. And when we do that, then we're doing, according to the yogic system, I believe, what we're here for. It's really not about who did I kill, who killed me. It's really not about this choice was right, this choice was wrong. It's not about any of that. It's about leaping into the mystery of life and being as fully present with that as we are able. That's yoga. Blessed are warriors who are given the chance of a battle like this, which calls them to do what is right and opens the gates of heaven. And now it's interesting, he's going to sort of contradict everything he just said. But if you refuse the call to a righteous war and shrink from what duty and honor dictate, you will bring down ruin on your head. And then the ruin he describes as, decent men will talk about your disgrace. So now, suddenly shame, suddenly what? Right and wrong is coming into the dialogue. And disgrace for a man of honor is a fate far worse than death. So now we're all caught up in duality. What is going on here? These great heroes will think that fear has driven you from battle. All those who once esteemed you will think of you with contempt. It's like, what? What kind of a teaching is this, Krishna? And your enemies will sneer and mock you. The mighty Arjuna, that brave man, he slunk from the field like a dog. What deeper shame could there be? This is like a major trip about shame. This is like a guilt trip. If you are killed, you gain heaven, triumph, and you gain the earth. Therefore, stand up, Arjuna, steady your mind to fight. Indifferent to gain or loss, to victory or defeat, prepare yourself for the battle and do not succumb to sin. So again, once again, he's back in non-duality. So there's this weird thing in these 1, 2, 4 verses. And then, I believe he gives us the clue. He says, this is philosophy's wisdom. Now, hear the wisdom of yoga. And it's so interesting because it doesn't really set us up in the text. But it's fascinating. There's this major guilt trip right there in the middle. And it's not until after we're all caught up in shame and doubt that he says, but that's philosophy.
He wants to hook you.
Yeah. And here's yoga. On this path, no effort is wasted. No gain is ever reversed. Even a little of this practice will shelter you from great sorrow. Ah, it's so great. But you know what? I'll talk away the whole time. So we'll, to be continued, let me read you some Mary Oliver. This poem is called How Turtles Come to Spend the Winter in the Aquarium, Then Are Flown South and Released Back into the Sea. Remember, this poem so articulates exactly what the Bhagavad Gita is talking about. Somewhere down beach in the morning at water's edge, I found a sea turtle. Its huge head, a smoldering apricot. Its shell, streaming with seaweed. Its eyes closed, its flippers motionless. When I bent down, it moved a little. When I picked it up, it sighed. Was it 40 pounds? Or 50 pounds? Or 100? Was it 2 miles back to the car? We walked a little while, and then we rested, and then we walked on. I walked with my mouth open. My heart roared. The eyes opened. I don't know what they thought. Sometimes the flippers swam at the air. Sometimes the eyes closed. I couldn't walk anymore. And then I walked some more. While it turned into granite or cement. But with that apricot-colored head, that stillness, that Buddha-like patience, that cold, shocked, but slowly beating heart. Finally, we reached the car. The afternoon is the other part of this story. Have you ever found something beautiful and maybe just in time? How such a challenge can fill you. Jesus could walk over the water. I had to walk ankle deep in the sand, and I did it. My bones didn't quite snap. Come on in and see me smile. I probably won't stop for hours. Already in the warmth, the turtle has raised its head, is looking around. Today, who could deny it? I am an important person. That's the yoga of action. That's it. How many of us would pick up the seat? Probably in this room, the only person, Dana and Sean. The rest of us would have kept on walking. Mary Oliver, she was quite the warrior in that moment, right? She just like picked it up and schlepped it to her car, you know? And I can imagine how heavy it was. And they bite, you know, and all the things we worry about. But she did the right thing, you know? She took something that was suffering and she brought it peace and she brought it safety and she brought it comfort. Sometimes I think that's all we need to do in this life, you know? Like, I know we have to like earn a living and we have to do all the things that we have to do, but underneath all that, I think it's... And I think that's what... That's where compassion comes. And it's sort of, if we can infuse all the mundane stuff that we have to do with that sense of compassion, that sense of we're adding to the beauty and comfort and safety of the world. And that's what makes us important. It's not our power and prestige in the world that makes us important. It's that ineffable essence that we leave behind.